my firm made $1 million for our investors, but my take of that as the junior partner, Dr. Richard, what I threw my career away for at 29 was $46,000, like the price of professional suicide.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Helping with Dr. Richard Schuster. Food for the brain, knowledge from the experts, tools to win at life. I'm your host, Dr. Richard. Whoever you are, wherever you're from, and whatever you do, this is the show that is going to help you become the best version of yourself. Each episode, you will hear from some of the most amazing, talented, and successful people on the planet who followed their passions and strive to help others. Join our movement to get 1 million people each day to commit acts of kindness for others. Together, we're going to make the world a better place. Are you ready? Because it's time for your Daily Helping.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Daily Helping Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Richard, and I am beyond excited to share our guest with you today. I'm purposefully omitting a large part of his story because it's just too unbelievable, and I can't wait for him to share it with you. But we're going to talk to Tom Harden today. Now, he spent much of his career as a financial analyst in the U.S. as part of a cooperation agreement with the Department of Justice, which would suggest he got in a little bit of trouble, which we'll talk about. Tom assisted the government in understanding how insider trading occurred in the financial service industry. He was invited by the FBI's NYC office to speak to their rookie agents, and now he is a global keynote speaker, international best-selling author, corporate trainer, board advisor on behavior ethics, compliance and organizational conduct and culture risk expert, and has delivered 600 plus keynotes. His latest book, Wired on Wall Street, is available everywhere books are sold, and he's here to share his story with us. Tom, we are honored. Welcome to the Daily Helping. It is awesome to have you with us today.
Oh, it's great to be here, Richard. Thank you for having me on the show.
Absolutely. So, you know, I teased it. So now we owe the audience a little something. So your story is pretty amazing. And usually when I start interviewing people, I ask them, hey, let's jump in your time machine. Let's go back in time and put you on the journey that you're on today. But your story is the journey, and it's an amazing one. So I'm going to take a sip of water and shut up and let you take us back to how all this started, and then we'll get into it.
Yeah. So, Dr. Richard, I grew up near you, the oldest of three brothers in the suburbs of Atlanta, Georgia. My father was a Coca-Cola man his whole career. They were going down 85 and battling the traffic. My mother stayed at home with us and ran a childcare business in our home. And I was the first in my family to leave the South for college, got into a Ivy League school back when we only applied to three colleges in the 90s, and that was my reach school and got in. And despite my guidance counselor's doubts, got into the school, Ivy League school, and really, you know, had a lot of ambition just as a child in college. And I had this drive to prove that I belonged. And so I got to the school, and I think it's also, as we're going to talk about later, that ambition, which was a positive character trait early in my life, is also exactly what later made me vulnerable. And so I think the same hunger that sort of got me into the school is what made me susceptible to crossing the line later on Wall Street.
So we will get to it. And I think, you know, the expression, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, right? Probably applies to your story. So, you know, first guy to leave the state, you applied to an Ivy League school, you got in, you graduated, and now you're in the real world. So what happens then?
Yeah, so I start working in finance and investment banking, and then I got recruited by a hedge fund. And so now we're getting into near the global financial crisis going back to 2007, 2008. And I'm at the small hedge fund. And one of the pivotal moments was we were investing when we started over a three-year horizon, like our best stock ideas. But after losing money in the first quarter, my boss came into my office, closed the door, and said, now we have to start looking for shorter term opportunities to make money every month, or we may not survive. So the goal just went for me at 28 years old from making money over 3 years to making money monthly. And we also knew, Dr. Richard, that insider trading, so buying or selling stocks on inside information, was prevalent at that time in the industry. I think there was a stat like 60% of stocks before they were bought by other companies were running up before the news was out. So just to set the stage for the environment at that time, it seemed to us that this illegal behavior was rampantly going on. It's not an excuse for what happened next in my story, but it sort of sets the stage in terms of what I was seeing at that time. So the pressure became enormous to make money every month, again, not an excuse. And also the awareness that the solicit activity was happening. You know, my competition was cheating to get ahead, you know, up to that point in my career.
Yeah, there's an expression down here, longstanding about the SEC, right? The football conference. If you ain't cheating, you ain't trying, right? So,
that's right.
You know, so apologies to all my SEC listeners, but I couldn't resist that one. So, but you're in this environment, it's a pressure cooker as is. Your 3-year goal became a month over month goal, and it was a survival based goal. Were you married yet at the time?
I just got married. So my wife at the time was working at a company called Lehman Brothers, which people may be familiar with, is no longer around, but she was working also in the pressure cooker.
Okay. But so you know, you're married, you're starting a life, you've got now this dilemma, right? You've basically been told, okay, do I start doing illegal things or not? And, you know, no spoiler, because we talked about you got in some trouble, you chose the illegal thing. Yeah. So talk to us about, though, what it was like wrestling with that decision. You know, was it agonizing? Did you rationalize it pretty quickly? What was that like for you?
Yeah. So just coming back to that meeting with my boss, me as the junior, I didn't ask any clarifying questions. Are we talking about, you know, what our competition is doing, which he knew what they were doing, or are we going to have legal, ethical guardrails? So I think it's just important, maybe as a leadership takeaway, like to ask clarifying questions if the message is ambiguous on goals. And so I never did. A few months later, I received a stock tip from another analyst who said, you know, Tom, you made me a lot of money over the last few years on some great longer term ideas. I have something for you. It was a blatant stock tip about a company that was going to be acquired by another company that was not public. I didn't make any trades at that time because it sounded like an illegal tip. But then later that day, I shared it with a friend who was losing money. I said, hey, if you want to trade this, I'm not going to do this for now. And so by right there, by tipping, so people know, the other SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, can actually charge people SEC. Just for tipping. They can actually charge people for tipping inside information. So anybody listening that works at a public company, you know, you really have to protect information that's not public. We see these cases all the time, you know, tipping family members. And so by tipping him, I exposed myself, but I told myself I was just helping him. He buys a bunch. He's going to make millions if this happens. And so, Dr. Richard, I'm looking every day and the stock's moving up every day. And I thought I had a little bit of FOMO, like this guy's going to make millions. The woman that called me is going to make millions. And I'm just going to watch this happen. And when an employee crosses a line and actually commits fraud, there's something called a fraud triangle. So there's a need, a perceived need to cross a line. So with me, now we had to make money every month. Then there's an opportunity. So at my company, I could buy a stock as long as it was very small in our portfolio, like less than 1%, and not have to talk to my boss. So that was the opportunity. I remember Dr. Richard buying a small amount of stock in my portfolio. And the third part is the rationalization. So you mentioned the rationalizations. And I told myself the classic ones. It seems like everybody's doing it. I'll do it just this one time. I'm still a good guy and can cross this line. So this idea, you know, a fudge factor where,
right.
And I talk in my book about moral licensing, like, you know, I do all these great things. I'm a faithful husband. I go to church. I make donations. And so I banked all this good stuff in my life. It gave me license in my head to just cross a line on, this is one of four trades where it happened, and we make thousands of trades a year. So I tried to minimize my conduct, and I felt like it was dropping a penny in the Grand Canyon. And like, who would know these other guys are making millions? So again, I'm not making any excuses. I chose to cheat, and cheating is a choice, but that's what was going on in my head at the time. And my boss, when the trade happened, like I thought it would, he didn't ask me any questions. So he was willfully blind to the situation.
So this is making a lot of sense as to how you rationalize it. And I think many people could easily get themselves stuck in that kind of a conundrum. As I'm hearing you talk, and I'm realizing I don't know the first thing about insider trading, and I suspect most of the people listening to this don't either. So you mentioned that an analyst called you and gave you a tip. So let's do insider trading for dummies here. Sure. So how insider trading happens, you know, what was the motivation for that person to call you and give you that tip? Was it just being nice? Obviously, they were committing a crime too. How does it usually happen? Kind of give us just the 101 of what that looks like. And then I want to jump back into your story.
Yeah. So the way I looked at this and the way that the FBI, which we'll talk about later, was looking at the tip was that she was giving me the gift of information because I had given her my legitimate, stock ideas over the years. So I guess I had made her money. I remember one of my best ideas was to be, own Google and short the Yellow Page stock. So younger listeners would not know what Yellow Pages are, but back in the day there was public companies. And so after Google went public, it was like, well, Yellow Pages are going to go away. And so that was the ideas that we give to her. So she tips me. So insider trading is trading a stock on information that's not public. So, you can't find it on the internet or newspapers or that type of thing. It's material. So if it were public, it would move the stock price. So as an example, like if I went to my Starbucks here in New Jersey in town and said, how was your sales this quarter? And he told me it wouldn't move the stock price. But if I flew to Seattle and asked Howard Schultz, how were sales this quarter? And Howard told me, then that would move the stock price. So that's illegal. And the insider has to actually breach their duty to their company or their client. So the tip that she gave me was that a Moody's analyst at the bond rating agency, not to get too technical, but his client was a public company who was going to be acquired by a private equity company. So he breached his duty to his employer, Moody's, by sharing his client's information. So she told me everything. And so I knew this was just not like a stock rumor. I had the exact information. And then I eventually placed, I told myself it was a small trade. So that's actually the details of insider trading. There's actually no law for insider trading. It's actually securities fraud. And today the discussion is really about Congress on both sides where they can get away with it, unfortunately.
So in her worldview, she was just doing you a solid. She was like, this guy's been great to me. Yeah. Let me help him. Okay. Yeah. So she might have known she was doing something nefarious, but probably didn't care and, just hooked you up. Okay. So that makes sense. Okay. So, we hear about this stuff. I think Martha Stewart got in trouble for this kind of stuff, right?
Now, yes.
That's she made a gargantuan amount of money doing this. Yeah. Can I ask how much money you made with all your inside trade deals?
So it was four tips where I made small trades over 7 months. My firm made $1 million for our investors, but my take of that as the junior partner, Dr. Richard, what I threw my career away for at 29 was $46,000, like the price of professional suicide.
Yeah.
And so you think about the opportunity cost of what I left in terms of career earnings for $46,000.
Oof, my goodness. Okay. So you said you'd now have made these four trades. So this is something that happened three other times, right? With these tips, and now you're on this kind of slippery slope, still, doing the donations at church and, but you've now, you're in it. And probably, I'm guessing, would have done more if you didn't get caught. So how in the world did the FBI figure out what was going on?
So the last trade was November of 2007, and then all the way to July of 2008, so many months later, I was leaving to drop off my dry cleaning in Midtown Manhattan where I was living, middle of the financial crisis, stepped on the sidewalk to hail a taxi, and I heard behind me, "Are you Thomas Covey Hardin?" And Dr. Richard, the last time I heard my full name was my mother back in Georgia about to whip my butt. And it wasn't mom. It was two FBI agents. You can just picture the scene. The wallets were out. FBI, come sit down with us. We sat down at Wendy's and he said, "Look, man, we know about your four trades. We know that you were just down in Georgia visiting your baby nephew for his baptism last weekend, and they knew his name." And Dr. Richard, my first thought was, "Oh my God, my dad's going to kill me. What's he going to say?" And I thought, "Oh my God, my wife's going to leave. She had no idea. We just got married. She had no idea about these trades. She's going to leave." And I thought, "Holy crap, this might impact my career. Oh my God, I might be going to prison." But it went from dad to prison. I start making implicating statements. Yes, I made those four trades. Both agents are writing it all down. So I'm not even sure what they knew, but I was just ready to confess at that time. And they said, "Hey, slow down, Tom, take a drink of water. We think you can help us build these cases. It's going to help you out." And I took the agent's card and said, "Should I talk to a lawyer?" And the agent said, we'll let you know when you can do that. So they're not supposed to say that. And two people like me, they approached on Wall Street that summer, tragically killed themselves that day. So luckily it wasn't that dark for me, but it was just a dark time where, you know, I took their card. I could only tell my wife and nobody else. And so I tried to go to the office, and then I told somebody else. I went for a confession because I converted to Catholicism for marriage. And I thought this is a great time to go to St. Patrick's there in Midtown. And I got in line for confession on that Tuesday, and I had gallows humor. Like, how many other hedge fund guys are in line for their confession? Told the priest, and my penance basically, he said, was to help the FBI. Now, anybody listening in the first 24 hours, talk to a lawyer too. So that's the most important decision you make. And I didn't talk to a lawyer for 2 years, but I could only tell my wife.
How did your wife take the news?
So that was a Tuesday morning with the FBI. She was working at Lehman Brothers, I mentioned. And so she was going through hell at work. And so I waited till Friday. I was having panic attacks, bed sweats. She was texting me, is everything okay? And I just had excuses. Hey, the market's horrible, which it was. Friday after work, young couple in New York City, no glass of wine. How was your week? And I said, let me go first. I said, Tuesday morning, the FBI. And I accepted I accepted responsibility that I made these trades, these four trades. I'm not sure what this means. And she said, can you do it again? Say it again. I said it again, and she paused forever, and she said, well, you didn't do anything to hurt me, and if they're giving you a chance to clean up the industry, you should probably do it. I learned later when I was researching the book that 85% of marriages end in this situation, or you know, around this time when right. The spouse is now no longer, you know, the breadwinner is going to be a convicted felon or FBI informant, and it was not easy. But I hope people see who read the book that I'm not the hero. She made it through, and she accepted it as best as she could at that time.
That's amazing. And that statistic makes perfect sense to me. I imagine, even though as stress-inducing as it was, tremendous relief, at least getting that off your chest to your wife and knowing that she was going to stand by you. Talk to us about the call with your dad.
Yeah, so that was tough. He didn't even know, because I couldn't tell anybody, not even my parents, until January of 2010. So it's almost 2 years later.
Okay, so it was quite a bit later.
Yeah. It was, so I was going through all my crazy situations where the FBI had lunch with me and they showed me a small piece of metal. I said, what's that? And they said, this is a body wire. You're going to have to get people in conversations, who I didn't know that well, build relationships, get people in conversations about their own trade. So they would put me into situations like at a Starbucks. I would meet with the big hedge fund guy, maybe in California. And my cover story for the meeting was, I'm a young guy, probably going to lose my job at the financial crisis. And then I had to get them in the conversation, Dr. Richard, in the terms of, like, I would say, and by the way, how do you get your information for your stock trades? And so if you just met me, you'd look at me weird, like, why is this young guy asking me all these very pointed questions about the crimes I committed? So people would shut it down. The FBI would listen later, and they coached me on this. And they said, one tactic, Tom, is to ask the question and then say nothing, be comfortable in the silence. And eventually people would start talking about contacts they had, or once they got to know me, and then the FBI would go approach them. And I had no idea where this was going for 2 years, getting people in these conversations. My wife, Sue, would ask me, how's it going? You know, I had no idea. And then one day the FBI called and said, turn on CNBC. 20 guys were in perp walks, you know, handcuffs, where the news cameras just happen to be at their homes when they're being arrested. And there was one name who was not released, and they called this person Tipper X. And I called the FBI, my Tipper X. They said, that's you. Now it's time to talk to a lawyer.
Hey guys, Dr. Richard here. For the past 7 years, I've been privileged to bring you incredible guests who are changing the world and can help you become the best version of yourself. I'm really excited to share with you a new quiz that I created based on my clinical training that will curate for you a custom list of my top episodes and actionable strategies to help you wherever you are on your journey. All you need to do is go to drrichardschuster.com to take it, and it's 100% free. You'll be taking the next step on the journey to unlocking the power of you, and I can't wait to see where you'll go.
Did they tell you, as these FBI agents started with you, I mean, obviously they surprised you on the street and you made the decision that you were going to be an informant for the Bureau. Did you have an inkling or any promise from them? Hey, if you cooperate, less punishment. I mean, what was the carrot that was dangled for you?
There was no carrot at all. There was actually really no threat of arrest or anything. They just said, here's the situation. It's going to help you out. And Dr. Richard, I just thought, you know what? I should probably just start helping them out. It wasn't, I didn't think about this. And people may read the book and be like, this guy's a rat. I kind of felt I knew people whose business model was just insider trading. And so if I'm in this situation, I'll help them with who I thought are the worst actors. And eventually they were asking me about two friends who I had tipped on one of the stocks. And I drew the line there. I said, that's a code I can't cross. These are good men. I actually know they're both starting families. I can't bring them down. So I had to draw the line somewhere. Otherwise, this would keep going on for years.
If that makes sense. And I'm curious too, as I'm thinking about this, you know, most of us only really hear about FBI wires from movies and television, right? I'm
yeah.
thinking about the Mafia or Sopranos as you're telling yeah. me this kind of stuff, right? So you're obviously a guy who had no training in this, right?
Right.
And yes, they're giving you tips on, oh, you know, the silence. That's actually a sales technique that my first yeah. boss out of college taught me. You know, once you make yeah. your offer, you shut your mouth and you know,
yeah,
the silence exactly. gets people talking. So I'm curious, you know, what was that like for you? What did you learn about people as you were, you know, the wire guy? What was that like?
Yeah, it was interesting because you had to sort of time the silence. And I developed this whole framework in the book I called the trace method. So it sort of timed the silence. When they start talking, reflect it back to them, kind of like use their own language, which again, these are all kind of sales negotiation tactics. You know, have empathy. So just sort of like, yeah, the market's terrible right now. I know I'm struggling too. And just sort of be on their page. And then, you know, sort of cue subtle statements like, okay, this is what, you know, I think you're saying, and this is how I get my information. And just elicitation. So again, these are, you know, CIA spies use these tactics and just trying to elicit, you know, radical empathy, elicitation. So these are all tactics I use, which are great sort of spy tactics. But I didn't know what I was doing at the time until I actually was doing all my research for the book. And it was a crazy aha moment where I was talking to another author who had spent time with CIA spies. And he said, this is exactly what I was doing, but I had no training, to your point. I was just figuring it out. And I was so terrible at first because I was so uncomfortable with the silence. I would fill it. And the FBI would say, don't do that. And I'd say, hey guys, it's my first time doing this. Like there was no training, you know, at the FBI Academy for wearing a wire. I had to just figure it out.
Most of these guys you were interviewing, if not all of them, were these white collar, you know, financial yeah. industry guys. You know, it wasn't the mafia, right? But right. did you fear for your life as you were doing this?
Not, well, I was just scared of being caught. So there's probably 17 times in the book of me saying my palms were sweating and my heart was racing. My editor told me, I'm like, well, this is exactly what was happening. I was sort of feared of being caught in the moment. And there was one situation where there was a guy high up the FBI's list who invited me to his house on a Sunday, and I thought he was going to confess. And he picked me up at the train station in Connecticut, and he's like, Tom, I have swim trunks for you. We're going swimming at my mother's house. And Dr. Richard, the Sopranos final season was going that summer, so all these ideas were going through my head.
Oh, man.
I got in his car. We went to this old swimming pool. He starts disrobing in this room. I said, hey, I'm going to go to the restroom. I took the wire out, put it in my jeans, put these swim trunks on. So the two of us were walking out to this pool. It was so quiet. I saw like a shovel against the house, a hole in the ground. I thought, is he going to try to kill me or something? And he was just having landscaping done. We got into the pool and he grabs a tennis ball. We're playing this awkward game of catch. And he said, Tom, I have to ask you one question and you have to tell me the truth. And I was so scared I was going to tell him. He said, Tom, have you been approached by the SEC, again, the Securities and Exchange Commission? And for me, no, it was the FBI, which is law enforcement, not right. the regulator. And I was paltering to him, trying to give him a hint. I said, no, not the SEC. He started making every implicating statement. He just said, I'm so sorry. I had to make sure you're wearing a wire. This guy was one of the worst guys. He was never charged. So they arrested 81 people. I had another 10 on my list. I said, where the heck are these people? And they were never charged. But that was the situation where I thought my life was in danger. I'm not a good swimmer. I'm in the swimming pool. What the heck's going on? And then I, you know, got back and gave the FBI the wire and told them, they're like, oh, sorry about that. You know, we didn't see that coming.
So yeah, didn't have the waterproof gear for you. So yeah, that one missed out. So let's jump back, you know, to the CNBC thing. You know, you're seeing all these people taken away, and now you know that you were Tipper X, which isn't the end of the story, right? So, what happens next?
It's almost just starting here where I'm Tipper X. So my name is still private, but, you know, Wall Street gossip is going around. Who was Tipper X? Who was Tipper X? And then eventually the FBI tried to get me to wire on two friends. And I felt I had to draw the line there. I said, you know, I brought you who I felt were the worst actors who you just arrested. I'm not going to go any further. And by then I'd hired a lawyer. My lawyer couldn't believe it. He's like, you've been doing this for 2 years without counsel. And he said, Tom, you're supposed to hire me the first day the FBI approached you. I said, hey, it's my first time doing this. You know, constant theme. And then eventually the FBI said, okay, if you're not going to wire in your two friends, your name's coming out tomorrow. So my name came out on the front page of the Wall Street Journal on a Wednesday morning. I remember in January, my wife, Sue, had just gone back to work that week on Monday from maternity leave. So an emotional moment for any new mother going back to the office. So on Monday, she's showing pictures of the baby to her colleagues, a very happy day. On Wednesday, she's asking questions about her husband on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. She came home and it was the only time she really broke down. She was so amazing. And she just took the baby from my arms, walked in the corner of the room in our living room and said, I can't believe you did this to us. So my lowest moment by far was there, you know, as a husband, as a man, as now a father. It wasn't the FBI approach. It wasn't the swimming pool. It was when my wife just, you know, says those words to me. I thought, oh my God, what have I done? So that was tough. And then my parents were actually coming up on Saturday for my daughter's baptism. And so I tell them face to face what happened and just disappointment. Just, you know, I think anybody still loves their child, but just like, this is not what you're expecting. You're expecting success, not my child is a major FBI informant, right? So I rationalized, you know, who am I hurting? Like, I'm just buying a stock, but committing a federal crime and, you know, you hurt everybody who knows you. Just because you lose complete trust, people feel like, well, I knew that Tom was a good guy and a good Ivy League educated middle class kid who made it, and now he's this. So, you know, I lost so many friends, so many connections. You figure out who your true friends are. I don't recommend going through something like this, but I did get sort of four texts that day. Hey, I saw if you need to grab a coffee or a drink. You know, I know who you are, but lost a lot of people in my life because they just, you know, lost trust in who I was.
So once the word was out and people knew you were Tipper X, you know, then take us through the next series of moments.
So really, you know, Tipper X is out there. I got some threatening phone calls and emails, and I had the FBI look into it, and they always told me, you know, I'm safe. So to your question about, I feared for my safety now that I was public. And they said, no, you're fine. And after a few weeks, it kind of just died down. But now I was just sort of in this shame spiral. You know, I told myself, I'm a stay-at-home dad. Thank God my wife, she was able to find a job after Lehman Brothers went under so she could work. But Dr. Richard, we were so optimistic. Like, we bought our house on double income, which was not a good financial decision because we just thought, I'll find a job. But it was a non-starter. I'm applying for jobs. Anytime you have to check the box for a felony, nobody's going to call back. And so Sue, my wife, was amazing. Just sort of like, be the best stay-at-home dad you can be. And that's a job. Any stay-at-home parent knows it's a real, real job. But I'll say I was just in a pretty massive shame spiral. You know, shame is, I'm a terrible person, you know, who did a bad thing. And eventually my wife signed me up for a 5K race just to get me focused on doing something outside the house. And 5Ks became marathons, became ultra marathons. And I figured out I could just run all day and not have to deal with what I was dealing with at home in terms of my professional future. But running was good in a way in terms of like just getting outside the house, but also doing it so crazy, like ultra marathons, I think, were not good in the end in terms of like, just, it was sort of an addiction almost for me to not have to deal with my situation at home. And I'll also say self-help books didn't help me at all. Like, I was always in the bookstore or Amazon reading all the self-help books, and the problem with that was those books made me feel, think more about myself, which is not good. And so I just started volunteering at our church again, to my wife's, encouragement, just go volunteer at church at night. And when you're in service to others, you start to have perspective. And so that gave me some perspective on my situation. And then eventually the FBI, of all things, years later called me, and I thought, oh my God, what do these guys want now? And they said, only if I wanted to, would I come talk to the FBI in New York City. because of the 81 people they arrested, I was the youngest and I made the least amount of money, the $46,000. And I said, thanks for rubbing it in, guys. I was trying not to get caught. And they said, that's really interesting, the psychology of what happened, the rationalizations, and spoke at the FBI. And then I just said, this is something I have to do. I have to just get out there and try to make an impact with a, you know, a cautionary story, not professionally at first, just sort of as my therapy, talking to audiences about this.
And so it's interesting. It's the FBI's call, which led to your redemption arc, if you will, right? This was a movie, right? So at what point, as you started speaking and educating more people about this, when did you learn to forgive yourself?
That was the final part. And it's such a great question because it's the most important thing somebody has to do that blows up their own life or anything like this. So self-forgiveness, I think, is the hardest part of this when anybody does something to, you know, really blow a hole in their marriage or their life. And so that was a long journey. The first part for me was I really had to accept responsibility and said, yes, I didn't make mistakes. You know, four trades were not mistakes. I made bad decisions. So I think it's important not to call our bad decisions mistakes because we don't own them. So that was really an important thing for me to say, no, I made choices. This was not accidental. So that was one part of just accepting responsibility. Then I had to just sort of reach out to people. And I hadn't talked to you for years because I was waiting for them to reach out to me. But by reaching out, getting coffees, just getting out there again and rebuilding relationships was important. And apologizing for people to people sort of as a, you know, maybe a 12-step type thing in terms of like what I put them through. Because everybody that knew me at work had to disclose that they knew me in the industry. And they were put through the ringer. Maybe he tipped you and, you know, I didn't with these people. But that was hard to apologize. And the hardest part was self-forgiveness. I was going through such a massive shame spiral, even when I started speaking 10 years ago. And there was one event where the event planner pulled me aside and said, you know, people really liked your talk, but they also felt you were not in a good place mentally. And we always want the audience to feel the speaker's okay. And she said, you're going through shame. And shame is I'm a terrible person who did a bad thing. Guilt is, you know, I'm a regular person who did a bad thing. And that was really important unlock for me in terms of the path towards self-forgiveness.
I mean, everybody loves a redemption story, right? And, you know, it's one thing to make mistakes or to make bad choices, as you had said, to use your language. But it's another thing to take ownership for that, not only how it impacted you, but how it impacted your loved ones, your friends, extended family, etc. And so now let's flash forward to today. Your book is out. It chronicles your story. Yeah. They say time is a flat circle. Tom, what are lessons that we can take from your story?
You know, I wrote it so that the next person kind of standing at that line, maybe in their career and life, has a voice in their head and says, you know, I know how this ends, don't do it. And, you know, ethical failures rarely begin with big crimes. It's a small rationalization. So it's one part cautionary tale. But you mentioned redemption, and I just want people to know that redemption for anyone, it's not about erasing what happened. It's about using it. I think it's using it to light the way for someone else. And I guess I didn't get the life I planned, you know, the prestige, the hedge fund wealth. But in the end, the final sentence in the book is I got something better and not easier, but better, being, you know, sort of rich in moments today, but not rich in wealth. And I think that was something that I was not so focused on, you know, early in my career, but I got to that place.
I love that. I want to talk a little bit about your relationship with your wife, because there were two moments, right? There was, you came home. Oh, how was your week? Well, you know, FBI, right?
Yes.
And she stuck by you.
Yes.
But then when the Wall Street Journal, the day that she's trying to show, or a couple days after, she's trying to show pictures of your newborn girl to all of her coworkers, you're on the front page of the Wall Street Journal as Tipper X. And she said, how could you do this to us? But she stayed with you even so. So talk to us about that process of repairing and restoring your relationship with your wife during that time.
It's really kudos to her, because I was even difficult at home after the insider training. Now her husband's addicted to these ultra marathons, and every weekend I'm somewhere and I'm not around to be with her to really, you know, I guess kind of figure out our family's future financially, because we bought the house on double income. But she was just giving me space, and she would always say, Dr. Richard, you got us into this. I have faith you're going to get us out of this. And the first time I really talked to her about deeply her experience was really last year when I wrote the book. I hate to say it, I was so focused on myself and poor me. And then 17 years later, as I write the book, I said, "Sue, what was it like for you?" And she said, "Thanks for asking, because you never did." Yeah. And she really told me that, you know, what it was like for her. And I didn't remember the whole sequence of it being 2 days after she went back to work from maternity leave. I said, "I thought it was a couple years." She was like, "No, Tom, it was 2 days later, and I dealt with that." But she said, "I knew who you were. We got married young. I knew who you were as a person. You made a series of bad choices." And the first time she was ever publicly spoke about it, I had an event where I had to give two talks, and she came with me. And the second talk, I asked her, "Are you comfortable if I interview you about your experience?" Which is kind of the reason I wanted to write the book, to get her story on this, her side out there. And she told, you know, questions about all this stuff we just discussed. And there was a woman in the audience that said, "Sue, how did you get through all the bad times?" And with no prep, she said, "There was good times before all this. Tom talks about the tough times, but there were no bad times because we never turned against each other." And that's the biggest mic drop, you know, of the whole thing. And that's the way she processed it. So I think the most important decision you can make is who you choose to spend the rest of your life with. And I made four bad choices, but I think one very good choice.
It sounds like it, to be sure. You've talked about the running a couple of times, both pejoratively and as a strength. I imagine that the running, you said it serves as an addiction for you. I mean, literally, no pun intended, you were running from your problems.
Yes.
But also, the discipline needed to become an ultra marathon runner is unbelievable. And it probably was valuable to you, not only with what you were dealing with and other aspects of your life. Talk to us a little bit about that.
It gave me such structure to my days. Thanks for asking, because, you know, some days if the baby was sleeping in, I would set the alarm and it's 10:30 if we were up late, you know, with the feeding or something, and I'm the stay-at-home dad. There was nothing for me to do other than, you know, tend to her needs, which are anybody with little kids knows is a lot. Then eventually I would just set my alarm to get her run in before Sue went to work. And then when she got home from work, I would run again. So I'm running twice a day to train for these races. And it just gave me, the only thing I could focus on was just getting myself in better physical shape. I had gotten technically obese on the BMI with my doctor, and just having something to do during the day, just having some structure in the day, run, take care of the kids, run again, was also a helpful way for me to sort of get out of the shame spiral a little bit. Like, I have to go for a run, and running, as people that run, it's very meditative. It's different than cycling, where you have to really be focused on the road. Sort of running, you can be out there in parks and doing that. But just having a reason to set the alarm was really important, because otherwise, you know, I'm not sure I would have bounced back as quickly. So there were positives to the structure to the day, but also I think I overdid it, and it became a negative in terms of me not focusing on our professional, because I had to figure out a way to you know, get my life back in order in terms, you know, professionally.
In the beginning, you mentioned that it was your ambition, your drive, that led to these issues. And so you wrote the book in part to be a cautionary tale, in part to tell your wife's side of the story. And temptation's a fascinating thing, right? I mean, it's as old as human history. In the Old Testament's first story is about temptation, right? With the Garden of Eden. And so what are the things, if you're talking to somebody, well, you are, everybody listening, what would you like to tell people based on your experience about temptation?
Yeah, temptation, it is very easy. We all rationalize decisions. We're all human beings. And it's very easy in the moment to rationalize anything. And so if you had told young Tom back in college, this is going to be your story, I'd say, it's not going to be my story because I'm a good person. You know, doesn't matter. We see people, good people all the time, do things they shouldn't. I was also so focused, Dr. Richard, on my reputation, like what people thought of me in my career, the titles I had, the status, when I completely neglected my character, like the choices I was making every day. That includes who I was surrounding myself with. So I started surrounding myself with people who really played in the gray area in my industry. And so if I could go back and talk to young Tom, you know, focus a lot more on your character and not your reputation, because if you set your character correctly, There's a quote from John Wooden, the coach, that says this exact thing. You know, your reputation is not what matters. It's what people think of you. Your character is actually what matters. And for the book, I actually developed a concept from that, referencing Coach Wooden and just talking about the integrity gap, like trying to close the space between what people think we are, which is our reputation and our character, what we actually are. And so I speak to a lot of young people today, early in their careers and students. So that's something to think about, anybody in their career. And also for younger people, just to be focused, like have a mentor in terms of somebody like where you want to be in your life, maybe 10 years out from you. And as I wrote the book, it was almost an insight I didn't have on the speaking journey before this, that I didn't really have any mentors that I was checking in with. That was just sort of freewheeling with, you know, my career and not sitting down and having those important conversations.
I want to shift because I think most listening to this would agree that corporations aren't getting any more ethical.
That's for sure.
So, you know, what happened to you was, you know, over 20 years ago and, or around 20 years ago, I should say. And so what are things that we can take from the book that would apply today that are thematically important?
Yeah. So a couple of things, especially for people that are in a leadership role in the company, think about where you could be giving ambiguous messages to your employees and having the employees are filling in the gaps. I've had so many companies bring me in to share the story where they've had their own issues with an employee in a situation maybe like mine, another industry where they can't talk about it because of employment law. And it often starts where a leader sent an ambiguous message, do what it takes maybe to meet the quota. The employees ask, what do you mean? The leader says, don't question my communication. You know what I mean? And so the ambiguity becomes totally undiscussable and you have a culture of silence. So I would say, that's how it starts. And that when you have a culture of silence where people can't raise issues, that's something today. Another thing today I'm brought in all the time is to speak to companies when they have speak up programs. And so many companies tell people they want them to speak up, but they actually don't want them to, because when employees do speak up, they never hear back about their concerns. And so today in 2026, if you're going to tell people to speak up, you have to listen up as leaders and get back to people. Thank you for raising that. You know, we looked into it or whatever it was. But there's a sense of, I think, especially with Gen Z, like they want to see organizational justice. They want to see, okay, if they're told to speak up, that you get back to them. So that's something I would give to people today to just to think about. And one final piece on this is every company I speak at has a code of conduct. And it's always ask yourself these five questions if you're ever not sure. I always want to rip them up. Just ask yourself one question. If I make this decision, am I willing to be held accountable for that decision? And that's, I think, all we have to ask ourselves.
You know, one of the quotes that I use often in my life, and I didn't invent this. I heard this first from Hal Elrod on one of his podcasts. He said, do what's right, not what's easy.
Yes.
And that flows right along with that. Tom, I have loved our conversation today, and I looked at the clock, and I cannot believe how much time has flown by. You might have just done it, so we might have shot ourselves in the foot here. But as you know, I wrap up every episode by asking my guests to share their biggest helping, essentially the single most important piece of information for somebody to walk away with after hearing our conversation. So what would that be for you?
The gap between who you appear to be and who you actually are is the most dangerous place to live. And I call it the integrity gap. And closing that gap every day is the hardest and most important work any of us will ever do. If I can do it after what I did, anyone can.
Amazing. Well said, Tom. The book is called Wired on Wall Street. That is available everywhere books are sold. And we will have a link to that in the show notes if you want to grab a copy for yourself. But if people want to learn more about you, Tom, where can they find you on the internet?
They can go to tipperx.com, TIPPERX.com. U.S. Patent Office just gave me the trademark on TipperX last month. So I'm the only TipperX out there on the internet.
Congratulations for that. And for those of you in the car, we got you covered. Everything, Tom Hardin, TipperX, will be linked in the show notes at drrichardschuster.com. Well, Tom, thank you for joining us today. Your story was amazing. I am so grateful for your vulnerability and honesty. I think a lot of people are going to take a lot from this.
Thanks so much, Dr. Richard. It's a pleasure.
Absolutely. And to each and every one of you who took time out of your day, thank you for listening as well. If you liked it, if you were inspired, go give us a follow and a 5-star review on the podcast app of your choice, because this is what helps other people find the show. But most importantly, go out there today and do something nice for somebody else, even if you don't know who they are, and post it in your feeds using the hashtag MyDailyHelping, because the happiest people are those that help others.